to tragedies. This is the reason for the catastrophe the Ukrainian people are going through. They have become hostage to the coup d'etat and the resulting criminal regime of its Western masters, collateral damage in the implementation of the cruel and self-serving plans.
Vladimir Putin also criticized the demolition of monuments to Soviet soldiers and said the West is creating a Nazi cult. The president pointed out that the desecration of a generation of victors is a crime.
It is a crime, an outright revanchism on the part of those who were cynically and blatantly preparing a new march on Russia and who brought together neo-Nazis come from around the world for this. Their goal, and there is nothing new about it, is to break apart and destroy our country, to make null and void the outcomes of World War II, to completely break down the system of global security and international law, to choke off any sovereign centers of development.
At 14, I became a partisan, then an infantryman machine gunner. This is our victory, and we have won this memory. We see the depressing example of Europe. I want to say that Russians will never forget this day and will always remember it. Here, it will always be honored.
I'm from Makeyevka, from Donbas. My entire mining family has perished since 2014. Only one son remained. And today, I've come here in Moscow to pay my debt to all the defenders, the soldiers of our past and present.
Unlike last year, the Russian president did not announce new measures to support the participants in the special military operation, but noted the leaders of the CIS countries who came to celebrate Victory Day in Moscow. Together with Putin, the leaders of Armenia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan watched the parade on Red Square.
For millions of Russians, May the 9th is a lot more than a national celebration. Today, Russians celebrate their victory over the Nazis in 1945. The Russians are one of the last who celebrate this holiday officially, remember which side were the heroes, and at what cost the Soviets got this victory. Marina Kartanova, Moscow.
Israeli warplanes carried out a series of airstrikes at Pride on Tuesday, which resulted in the death of three high-profile military commanders of the Islamic Jihad movement, Tariq Izzeddin, Khalil al-Bahdini, and Jihad al-Ghanim. The Ministry of Health confirmed the death of 13 Palestinians altogether, including women and children, among them the wives and children of the Islamic Jihad commanders. 20 others were also injured, some of them in serious condition. The Israeli airstrikes, which targeted the middle of the Gaza City and Rafah and Khan Yunis in the southern of the coastal enclave, caused a great destruction of the residential apartment buildings as well.
I was asleep, and suddenly the explosion broke out and the rubble fell on us. My granddaughter was asleep by my side. We both woke up, not able to see anything from the destruction.
The Israeli occupation has a record in killing Palestinian civilians, children and women. Today, Maya Ezzeddin and Haja al-Bahdani, two Palestinian girls, the daughters of the Islamic Jihad leaders, fell victim to the Israeli attacks, like the other thousands of innocent children that were killed before.
Palestinian resistance movements have mourned the martyrs and the family members and condemned the Israeli assassination. In several statements released, they have warned the Israeli occupying regime of the scale and the scope of the Palestinian response to the crime.
The Israeli assassination of the Al-Quds Brigade's commanders is going to cost the Israeli occupation a heavy price. It is a legitimate right to fight the Israeli occupation, and it's the resistance's duty to defend the Palestinian people against any Israeli aggression.
The heinous atrocity of the Israeli occupation that resulted in the assassination of three senior leaders of the Islamic Jihad movement and other civilians will see the Palestinian resistance factions unite in their crushing response as usual. We have the right to resist the Israeli occupation, as it continues to commit war crimes against our people.
Thousands of Palestinians carried the bodies of the martyrs from the hospital to the Grand Al-Umari Mosque and then to the final destination to bury them in the northern Gaza Strip. Thousands of Palestinians took to the streets to express their anger over the Israeli crime that resulted in the death of innocent women and children. Palestinians are now calling for retaliation. The Palestinian resistance factions are now preparing for a crushing response to the Israeli attack and the assassination of the Islamic Jihad commanders, affirming their unity against the regime. Ula Al-Asi, Gaza.
The fifth international exhibition of the export capabilities of Iran is underway at Tehran International Permanent Fairground from May 7th to 10th. The event aims to help companies export their products, develop new markets, and promote their industries while focusing on the importance of non-oil exports. One of the most successful contributors to Iran's non-oil revenues is the country's free industrial and trade zones, which accounted for one-third of the country's non-oil exports last year. During a press conference, the secretary of Iran's Free Zones High Council said 370 major investment projects are going to be executed in seven free trade zones across the country, and all investors are welcome to participate in these projects.
Our colleagues have conducted preliminary studies about investment in the seven free industrial and trade zones. Preliminary justification plans have been prepared, which shows that these projects are going to be profitable. Studies related to the market, land, energy, etc., have also been conducted.
There are seven active free zones in Iran, including Kish, Chabahar, Qeshm, Anzali, Aras, Arvand, and Maku. According to official statistics, the free zone's productions were about $1 billion last year. One of the most important free zones with lots of potential is the Chabahar Free Zone.
Chabahar Free Zone is located near the Mokran coastal region. Based on the description of the Islamic Republic of Iran's leader, this region is a hidden treasure in Iran. He has mentioned this several times. As the third energy hub of the country, petrochemical units are going to be opened in Chabahar. These units will begin production after 2 years, and their products will be ready to be introduced to the global market.
Free zones have helped the process of development of Iran through providing conditions that have attracted foreign investors.
Customs and transportation services are much better in the free zones. Also, there are better investment opportunities there. Aras Free Zone is one of the seven free zones in Iran. This zone has been very successful in industrial activities as well as agriculture.
Officials say the development of projects in free zones is expected to attract a huge volume of investment valued at $5 billion to Iran's economy. The projects are also going to generate new employment opportunities for 23,000 job-seeking people at large. Iran Expo 2023 has introduced hundreds of investment opportunities in the country's trade and industrial free zones. The free zones of Iran, as one of the important tools of development, play an important role in the prosperity of the national economy. Ahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
Srinagar, which is the main city of Indian-administered Kashmir, has been given a significant facelift, something that has not happened in decades. Roads are freshly finished, sidewalks fixed, cycle tracks laid, and new colorful signboards placed. All arrangements came after New Delhi-backed administration announced that it will host G20 meeting sessions in Kashmir. Now authorities say G20 meetings have come as a blessing to Srinagar's developmental projects.
We are at a very advanced stage of most of work in many of our projects. Similarly, what we are also doing is that we have started working in the double shift. So in the night also, the work keeps on going. So with the same intention that this progress of the work should speed up. Now, G20 came as a boon to us. It's a good opportunity for us to further speed up. And I think it has helped us in overall, pushing our work on top gear and helping us better coordinate and making sure that we complete many of these projects at a much faster pace.
The projects which were in a wait list for the past 5 years have been completed in a matter of no time. The citizens have appreciated the pace of the work but are criticizing some aspects.
For the people living in Srinagar, these projects make no sense. We wanted road widening for the ease of transport in the city center. Instead, they've shrunk the roads and broadened sidewalks. The administration is yet to make its decisions clear to the citizens. They've just made parts of Srinagar as a showpiece.
Smart city.
They have dug up the entire city and we are really fed up. There is no plan for the city. The businesses have been strongly dented. We are a tourism-based economy, but tourists are not even coming this way. So what sort of smart city planning is this? This is public money and people have not been taken on board.
India is expected to host 215 meetings at some 55 locations this year. Following India's move, Pakistan has accused India of exploiting its membership in G20 to advance its, quote, self-serving, unquote, agendas. However, India has called these decisions as internal matter. The meetings will be the first major international event held in Kashmir since Narendra Modi-led BJP government scrapped Kashmir's semi-autonomous special status in August 2019. The legislations divided the Muslim-majority region into two federally administered territories.
The stage is all set and Srinagar is all ready to host the G20 meetings. Experts say G20 meetings in Kashmir is an opportunity for India to display the return of normalcy in the conflict-ravaged Kashmir. However, people of the region say New Delhi's good work in Kashmir must not revolve around the G20 meetings alone. It must move beyond and look for the larger good of people who have suffered for decades. Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida became the first Japanese leader to visit South Korea for a bilateral summit after 12 years. Despite ongoing historical disputes, President Yoon has reached out to Tokyo with plans to possibly include Japan in its alliance with the U.S.
Washington. Both countries are exposed to North Korea's nuclear threats, and the military cooperation is needed more than ever. The Washington Declaration at the moment is an agreement between South Korea and the U.S., but we do not rule out the possibility of Japan's participation.
Japanese Prime Minister Kishida sought to reassure South Koreans over the impending release of contaminated water from the 2011 nuclear disaster. He also welcomed the opportunity for Japan to participate in a network of military alliances.
North Korea continues to carry out provocations in the region, and there is a sign that there is an attempt to change the current status by force. Based on this assessment, we agreed we have to strengthen deterrence and ability to respond to threats through Japanese-U.S. alliance, the South Korea-U.S. alliance, the South Korea-Japanese alliance, and the trilateral alliance.
Both supporters and detractors rallied outside the presidential compound. Many opposed President Yoon's outreach to Japan and militaristic pro-U.S. policies and question his patriotism.
Is President Yoon Suk-yeol, who is driving the Korean Peninsula towards Cold War confrontation while taking the lead in representing the interest of the United States and Japan, is he really the president of South Korea?
South Koreans have also been critical of President Yoon for creating a South Korean foundation to compensate victims of Japan's colonial rule. Improved relations between South Korea and Japan will no doubt be welcomed by the U.S., which wants to see a strengthened trilateral military alliance. And despite domestic opposition, President Yoon seems fully committed, with the largest ever joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises slated to start later this month. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Britain now has a new king. At the first coronation the world has seen in 70 years, the Archbishop of Canterbury crowned British royals Charles and Camilla at Westminster Abbey on Saturday, ushering in the reign of King Charles III. The main focus of British state media was the splendour and grandeur of the spectacle. However, controversy still surrounded the day. Anti-monarchy activists belonging to the peaceful Not My King protest movement were rounded up and arrested ahead of the coronation. The arrests included group leaders.
It's a completely peaceful demonstration. The police, without telling us why, without telling us where they're taking them, have arrested all the rallying organisers. They've seized all our placards. It feels like something out of a police state because we still don't know why anyone's been arrested and we still don't know where they're taking our people. You know? Britain's meant to be a democracy, but Charles isn't treating it like one.
Even before the event took place, criticism of the royal family remained relatively widespread. A survey by the National Centre for Social Research showed public support for the monarchy has fallen to a historic low. A total of 45% of respondents said either it should be abolished, was not at all important, or not very important. Young people particularly expressed embarrassment over the institution's continued existence. Elsewhere, similar polling revealed that many of the King's subjects across the Commonwealth would vote to remove the UK monarch as their head of state, raising speculation that more nations will ditch the Commonwealth in the near future. The ongoing cost of living crisis, undemocratic power, and seemingly endless scandals are among the many reasons experts believe the UK royals' popularity has plummeted.
I don't think anyone can be happy, especially looking at the economic state right now. Well, you only have to go out in the streets and some of the famous streets in London and look how many people are suffering and sleeping on the streets. And that is quite embarrassing and appalling for any sort of government, let alone a monarchy, to be proud to celebrate and spend that amount of money when people are suffering.
Why were many mainstream platforms? So what the royal family stands for today might be different, but it's very, very difficult to erase history. And they have to respect that a large portion of the public still connect them to, let's say, some incredibly sad, vicious and violent times.
The new monarch now faces many challenges, and they're not just including the social, economic and political crises which plague the nation, but also the deep divisions within his own family as well. Depending on how the king handles these many crises, could heavily impact the fight for survival that the royal institution now finds itself in. Robert Carter, Windsor.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
African Americans make up about 14% of America's population of 332 million. Almost a third of prisons across the United States are filled with African Americans. According to human rights activists, black people are the biggest systematic victims of police brutality in the United States. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. At the end of a historic two-week tour of the United States, a United Nations mission has concluded that the country must move beyond piecemeal reform and slogan-making and tackle the ongoing scourge of police brutality and law enforcement's discrimination against African Americans. United Nations experts completed their first official visit to the United States as part of a system of global inquiries set up by Human Rights Council after the police murder of George Floyd in May of 2020. As they ended their tour of the United States on Friday, 5th of May, in Washington, D.C., the United Nations experts called for a nationwide commitment to address discrimination suffered by Black Americans in their daily dealings with law enforcement. Dr. Tracy Kissi, one of two independent UN experts who conducted the visit, said, "In the United States, racial inequity dates back to the very creation of this country, and there are no quick fixes." Dr. Tracy Kissi added, "To this day, racial discrimination permeates through encounters with law enforcement, from first contact, arrest, detention, sentencing, and disenfranchisement." Dr. Kissi said, "What was needed was a whole government approach," adding, "This needs to be more than a slogan and calls for reform." In the course of their 15-day mission, Dr. Tracy Kissi and Juan Menendez of Argentina visited six U.S. cities: Washington, D.C., Atlanta, Georgia, Los Angeles, California, Chicago, Illinois, Minneapolis, Minnesota, and New York. Their mission was to investigate excessive use of force, militarized policing, racial profiling, and other human rights violations by law enforcement and penal agencies against Black Americans. As they crisscrossed the country, the United Nations experts had emotional encounters with families of the victims of police killings and brutality and other law enforcement abuses. In Minneapolis, Minnesota, where a white police officer murdered George Floyd on 25th of May 2020, the panel spent time with the mothers of Philando Castile and Amir Locke, who were also killed by law enforcement in Minneapolis. Presenting their preliminary findings, Dr. Tracy Kissi said they had witnessed a pattern that could be traced to what she called the deep intrinsic legacy of slavery and legalized discrimination. She said that across the country, there remained a lack of awareness and acknowledgement of the extent to which racial inequities were still prevalent in the United States. The United Nations experts said the result was a culminating exhaustion in the Black community. Juan Mendez of Argentina, a former United Nations Special Rapporteur on torture, said he had been moved throughout the visit by the harrowing pain of victims and their families and the resounding calls for accountability. Juan Mendez said, "We support those calls for accountability." He was heartened by successful prosecutions of police officers involved in high-profile killings, such as those of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor in Louisville, Kentucky. However, many more cases remained unresolved, suggesting a continuing degree of impunity. Juan Mendez added that their mission would be calling on U.S. Justice Department to make more serious and proactive use of its power through consent decrees to intervene in the inner workings of local police departments to address some of the most egregious abuses. Mendez said, "More robust government action is needed." The United Nations experts will present their final report to the Human Rights Council in Geneva, Switzerland in September or October of this year. They indicated that among the demands they are likely to make is a call for better nationwide data and record and record keeping. Juan Mendez said, in the absence of a national database, police officers who had complaints of misconduct or excessive use of force filed against them were allowed to continue serving, in some cases going on to be involved in killings of African Americans. He added, the mechanism also received allegations of police officers who were previously guilty and or disciplined for misconduct, afterwards being hired by a different police department. Among other likely demands signaled by the United Nations experts were, 1. A call for an end to racial profiling in policing in America. 2. A dramatic reduction in the use of solitary confinement in U.S. jails and prisons, and a total abolition of isolated incarceration for children under the age of 18. 3. Passage of George Floyd Justice in Policing Act, which tackles racial bias and excessive use of force by law enforcement, but which has stalled in Congress. 4. An end to stereotyping of black women and girls as angry and aged up. 5. Rooting out of white supremacist law enforcement officers to ensure that they no longer wear a police badge. The British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered the same story and tells us more. Activists have urged California State to provide millions of dollars in compensation to black American citizens as a means of apologizing for slavery and past injustices, rejecting the State Reparations Task Force proposal as inadequate. The 9-member Reparations Task Force, established through the state laws endorsed by Governor Gavin Newsom of the Democratic Party in 2020, has spent over 12 months on research while hosting sessions to listen to the public across California. Their efforts have culminated in a comprehensive plan on how to address various instances of racist injustices through restitution. The panel was receiving final feedback from citizens on Saturday, 6th of May, while examining ultimate proposals to present to the California Assembly, which will subsequently determine whether to execute the actions and forward them to Gavin Newsom's office for endorsement. The latest proposal came out recently suggesting a total amount of $1.2 million per person based on the average life expectancy. The estimates include a loss of $2,352 for every individual annually who resides in California due to excessive policing in black communities, a loss of $3,366 per individual annually for biased lending and zoning, a loss of $13,619 per individual annually for unfairness and prejudice in healthcare, and a loss of $77,000 per individual due to the devaluation and loss of black-owned businesses. Meanwhile, activists present at the gathering dismissed the current plan as insufficient. San Francisco is considering its own compensation plans at the community level, which consists of a suggestion to distribute $5 million to eligible black inhabitants. The report did not specify the expenses incurred by the state, but according to economists' approximations in March, the overall expenses due to the negative effects of housing and mass imprisonment could exceed $800 billion. In addition to monetary considerations, the task force suggests a number of policy modifications to address racial bias, including an official apology from the California legislature and from the governor of California for past instances of slavery and anti-black racism. A nonpartisan Public Policy Institute of California report revealed that in California, black families earn 60 cents for every dollar earned by white families. Nearly 6.5% of California residents, roughly 2.5 million people, identify as black or African American. Other cities across the United States have also moved forward with reparations proposals. Authorities in Evanston, Illinois, a suburb of Chicago, authorized $10 million in reparations as housing allowances in 2021. The San Francisco Board of Supervisors has also expressed support for reparations that could offer several million dollars.
This Monday. Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. The Israeli regime has carried out a series of strikes on Gaza, killing at least 13 people, including four children. Three members of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement and their families were also among those killed. The Ministry of Health says at least 20 others were also injured in the pre-dawn strikes. Meanwhile, Israeli forces have also intensified their crackdown against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. In this edition of Spotlight, we will discuss the reasons behind this escalation. We have with us Laith Maarouf, activist and political commentator, joining us live from Beirut. Also, Chris Williamson, host of Palestine Declassified, joining us from Derby, from the UK. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for joining us on this edition of Spotlight. Let's begin with Laith Maarouf. We have received different reactions from resistance groups, of course, all of them vowing to retaliate. Do you think that we could actually expect a united retaliation as it has been discussed? What kind of retaliation would that entail?
Well, we've heard statements by all the resistance groups in Palestine saying that they will be retaliating. So now we know at least inside Palestine there is a unified front. Much of Israel right now, at least the what is called the Gaza envelope, has been either evacuated or under lockdown. The schools are closed in the Zionist colony tomorrow. So what we should be expecting is the same as the Zionists are expecting. The Zionists are expecting a heavy blow as a response to this treacherous assassination of Islamic Jihad leadership in Gaza, that it will be something that will be felt across Israel. There's even the bunkers in Tel Aviv have been opened right now. So this gives us a hint where we're going.
Okay, now before we discuss how Israel will react to that, let's bring in Chris Williamson. Mr. Williamson, how united do you see the resistance front in Palestine? We do know that the Achilles heel for any resistance would be to not be united in their fight for whatever the cause there is. And, of course, the divide and rule policy is something that has proven to work. The name of the game here would be solidarity and unification. And how much do you see that among different Palestinian factions and resistance groups?
Well, first of all, let me say that this is yet another brutal response by the Israeli regime. And, you know, it's a time for the international community to stand up and to speak out against, I mean, you know, this continuation of turning a blind eye is totally unacceptable. But in terms of the resistance, you know, from what I've understand the situation to be from the various programs that we put on Palestine Declassified, we know that there's unprecedented unity now across Palestine in terms of the resistance, the kind of axis of resistance as it's known, right across all the different factions. So, you know, one of the things which I think, you know, the Israelis are finding difficult to come to terms with is the effectiveness now of the resistance and the ability of the resistance to strike back. And I think we will certainly see a response from the resistance to this latest brutal atrocity by the Zionist entity.
Okay, so Mr. Maarouf, in your opinion, why does the Israelis attack, when they attack these targets, Why don't they consider that there might be women and children there? Is this something that they do on purpose? They want to have women and children killed as well? Or is this some kind of collateral damage?
You know, the Zionists are brutal ghouls. They are blood hungry. They talk about our peoples in our region as if they're tribal, but in reality, if you see how they purposefully target the family and children of leadership in Palestine, meaning that they want to cut off the bloodline of a family, that is the most tribal and most vicious thing you can do. Also, it is important to note that these three leadership of Palestinian Islamic Jihad were on their way to Egypt. They were invited by the Egyptian negotiators who are mediating between the Zionist colony and Palestinian groups in Gaza on the release of an exchange of prisoners. They were invited by the Egyptian government to arrive in Egypt today, and they were supposed to leave the Gaza border at 9 o'clock in the morning, meaning the Zionists knew where that they will be doing so. And the Zionists saw that they are gone to see their families, to say goodbye to them before they go to Egypt, and they took advantage of that and assassinated them. So this is as vicious as the assassination of General Soleimani, who also was arriving to Baghdad on invitation of for negotiations of peace. So this is what the Zionists do. And finally, one last thing to say here is one of the civilians that were killed, other than the children and women, was the general chief of Al-Wafa Hospital, a very famous doctor in Gaza who headed at one point the Dentist Association. And he's a dual citizen, a Russian-Palestinian citizen. This was a very, very vicious attack, and it will receive a response very soon from the Palestinian resistance groups.
So, Mr. Williamson, Netanyahu has just said that they are prepared for any kind of scenario. On the other hand, we do know that Tel Aviv is now warning settlers living near the Gaza Strip to stay close to bomb shelters in the coming hours because, well, obviously, they fear that there might be retaliatory rocket attacks from Gaza. What does this mean when he says we are prepared for any scenario? If they have to go into shelters, that really doesn't mean to be prepared for a scenario. It just means running away from it.
Well, I think that's another indication, frankly, of the precarious state of the Zionist entity and the effectiveness of the resistance. We've seen and heard from very senior figures in the Zionist entity who have talked in terms of the regime and the whole Zionist edifice actually, you know, crumbling. You know, very senior figures, former prime minister have said that, you know, they fear that the Zionist project could end before the end of this decade. So I think, you know, the brave talk from Netanyahu, but, I mean, the reality is that, you know, the tide of history is against them. The effectiveness of the resistance is growing. International opinion is increasingly critical of the Zionist regime. And I think that, you know, the writing is on the wall, frankly, for a substantial change and the, you know, the fortunes of the settler colony there is very much in doubt now. And, you know, what we need now, of course, though, is to push our politicians in the West to actually, you know, recognize that they are supporting the last brutal apartheid regime on the globe. And, you know, we know that there was a huge opposition around the whole of the world in opposition to the apartheid regime in South Africa. And that was, you know, in the end supported by Western countries who previously fallen in line and supported the South African regime. And I think, you know, given the strength of public opinion in all Western countries now is moving in favor of the Palestinian cause and Palestinian liberation, will force the politicians to change their tune and to actually recognize that they, you know, they need to be supporting a change in the whole situation there, which is completely untenable and has been going on now, as we know, for 75 years. Completely appalling. And, we've got to keep the pressure up. That pressure is happening on the ground in Palestine, of course, but we need to be doing what we can outside of Palestine to continue to support the resistance there.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
So, Mr. Maruf, these strikes in Gaza, where does this leave Egypt as a country that has been trying to mediate? You just brought up the name of Egypt, and you did mention that negotiations were supposed to be underway before this happened. So where does that leave a country like Egypt, who's trying to solve the issue through diplomatic means? Then you see such kind of reaction from Israel. You have a long list of UN resolutions that are being neglected by the Israeli regime, not to mention that most of the actions by this regime are against the international law and international conventions.
Well, clearly the Egyptian government had made a statement condemning this assassination. We know that the Egyptian negotiators were really upset and sent a stern a response to the Zionists. They know that they have been put in a really bad situation now. The groups in Gaza now can refuse the negotiation efforts of Egypt. Since the morning, the Egyptian government has been trying to outreach to listen to Islamic Jihad, clearly to maybe ask them to not retaliate, but they have not been getting any responses from the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. And remember, Egypt, like the rest of the Arabic League, were moving towards ending hostilities between Arabic states and realigning themselves together with Syria and having a separate foreign policy, as we see the Saudis are attempting to do that too, from the United States and Israel. And already Egypt is in the heat right now with the manufactured war in Sudan that the Israelis and the Americans instigated to make sure that even if Egypt at one point decides to have a sovereign foreign policy, that it will not be able to deliver on it, having a ring of fire spanning from Libya to Sudan, cutting it from its surrounding and making its economy suffer with millions of refugees coming from Sudan.
Okay, so, of course, the regional developments are also very important in considering the situation in Sudan as well. We will discuss that later. But meanwhile, Mr. Williamson, do you think that Israel has left any room for diplomacy with its actions? Or have we reached that point of no return where it is now proven to any observer that once and for all that the only way to fight against Israel is the resistance of the Palestinian factions, and there is actually no room for diplomacy left?
Well, I think that's been the case for a good number of years now. I mean, the Israeli regime has always negotiated in bad faith. We saw that with the Oslo Accords. The reality is they were never interested in self-determination for the Palestinian people. But the tide, as I say, is turning. And, the resistance is becoming more effective. The BDS campaign is ratcheting up. We've seen now the rapprochement between Saudi Arabia and Iran brokered by China. China is now a much bigger player on the international diplomatic scene, as it were, taking the place, frankly, of the United States of America, which, you know, historically has always been supportive of the Zionist entity and continues to be so, bankrolling them to the tune of over $4 billion every single year. But, you know, the U.S.'s influence on the international scene is certainly waning. There is a new world order developing. You know, we're seeing different powers coming together, you know, the link between China and Russia and Iran and other major players coming together in the BRICS, as it's known. And, you know, this is, I think, a very significant development, which can only augur well, I think, for the future in terms of a multipolar world. We're moving away very rapidly from the unipolar world. I think we've already kind of, I think the unipolar world is gone anyway. Now we're already in that multipolar world with, as I've already mentioned, the influence of China now. And the interesting thing is, you know, China approaches its kind of its foreign policy developments and the way in which it conducts itself on the international stage, does it in a way to try and, you know, bring about peace and to try and, as it were, mutually developed nations rather than the sort of gunboat diplomacy that we've seen from the likes of the United States of America and the United Kingdom and others in the Western world. And things are definitely changing, in my opinion. But as far as diplomacy is concerned with the Zionist entity, I think, you know, they've never negotiated in good faith. And I think they need to be forced, frankly, now to bring about the change. And that's, I think, you know, that's already happening, as we've already said, with the resistance on the ground and pressure building from outside as well.
So, Mr. Maruf, you just heard Mr. Williamson's analysis of the recent developments as far as the political equations of the region is concerned, and, of course, with China playing a much important, more important role in the region. And how do you see the situation of Israel in the near future, maybe in the next 10 years?
Well, hopefully it will not be in existence in 10 years. It's clear that we are at the beginning of its collapse, and that comes, of course, coupled with the collapse of American hegemony and imperialism. Remember, I just want to put this out here. I don't think any pressure will change the minds of the leadership in the West about the Zionist colony. And that is because if the Zionist colony collapses, then the Western Empire will not be able to project its power over Asia and Africa and control the trade routes that are important there. It will be actually an acceleration of collapse of American imperialism. And this is why somebody like President Biden years ago said that if there was no Israel that was created by the Zionist movement, that the United States would have created it itself. So given those realities, we must understand that the only way to liberate Palestine is through direct confrontation with the Zionists and collapse of it under the pressure of resistance. There's nobody that's going to come to save the Palestinians. And there will be no Western negotiators to bring down the Zionists from the tree. This will be a battle to the end. And this is very important to understand, because if the Zionists were rational, or the imperialists were rational in terms of this issue, then we wouldn't see actions like we saw today. The clearer and closer we are to the liberation of Palestine, the more and higher possibility there will be of irrational actions by the Zionist colony and its backers, and as we see that happen today.
And, of course, let's not forget that Israel has been raiding the flashpoint city of Nablus, or the raids on Ariha, other parts of the occupied West Bank. So, Mr. Williamson, why is Israel attacking these parts of the occupied West Bank as well? Is it trying to deviate attention from its internal affairs?
Well, Well, I think certainly that is part of the reason. I'm sure it is. But also, of course, that, you know, they want to try and crush the resistance. But it's a forlorn proposition. I don't think they're capable of doing that. And, you know, we've seen how the resistance pushed back the Israeli ground forces a couple of years ago when they were seeking to another incursion into Gaza, and, you know, the resort to these brutal air raids. But, you know, I do think that external pressure does have a part to play. Of course, in the end, Palestinian liberation will be delivered by the resistance on the ground. But I think external pressure can play a part. And, of course, the imperialists who hold sway across the West at the moment are determined to, you know, maintain that position for the reasons that Marouf outlined. And we saw what happened when, for example, Jeremy Corbyn, who the leader of the opposition, the Labour opposition Labour Party in Britain, was within a hair's breadth of becoming the Prime Minister. Massive effort was put into destroying him and destroying his supporters. And, you know, that whole Corbyn legacy now has been utterly destroyed now within the British Labour Party. The Labour Party is nothing like it was under Jeremy Corbyn's tenure, because Jeremy did threaten that world order. He was somebody who was very supportive of the Palestinian cause and had been for decades and has spoken out numerous times in the Houses of Parliament in Britain. He was also in favour of peace on the world stage. He appointed a Minister for Peace and Disarmament, and, you know, we'd have had the prospect of Britain being a permanent member of the UN Security Council, promoting peace and disarmament around the world rather than war and arms sales. And that was unconscionable. Even Mike Pompeo, you know, the Secretary of State in the US, said words to the effect that, you know, they would not allow Corbyn to become Prime Minister. So there was certainly external interference there. So, yes, of course, the imperialists will do whatever they can, but the pressure is growing from the populace, as it were. And, you know, and these politicians are subject to election in these so-called Western democracies, and there is every prospect. I know that the Corbyn project was destroyed, but, you know, those people that were inspired by that haven't gone away. And so there is the prospect, I think, of getting new politicians elected to bring about the sort of revolution that, you know, we were hoping for under Jeremy Corbyn. And that's being replicated, you know, right across Europe and indeed in the United States of America as well. So I'm not, you know, totally pessimistic about the role of external pressure. I think it has a role to play and can actually help to hasten the demise of the Zionist entity. But look, as I've already said, you know, when you've got people like Naftali Bennett, the former Prime Minister of Israel, talking about, you know, the precarious nature of the Zionist entity, and other senior figures, you know, predicting former Prime Minister Barak talking about, you know, being ended within 10 years. I mean, they see the writing on the wall, it seems to me. So, you know, we need to obviously support the resistance wherever we can, and those of us who, you know, are not in Palestine, continue to put pressure on the policymakers to do whatever we can to, you know, up that and increase that pressure, that external pressure. Because that did, let's remember, play a part, that external pressure did play a part in actually bringing down the apartheid regime in South Africa. So, you know, we shouldn't be totally pessimistic about that, but we need to be realistic, I think, as Marouf has set out, but not actually give up on putting pressure, external pressure.